We'll proceed to the fifth case, Smith v. Jefferson County Board of Education. Ms. Bowen?
May it please the Court, Presiding Judge Flom, Judge Wood, and Judge Hamilton, I pronounce my name Richard Minning, without the O. In my initial comment or thought to begin the argument of the appellant is that it cannot be gainsaid that but for that single telephone call from West Virginia, plaintiff would be constitutionally free today. The district court claims that it lacks personal jurisdiction. It does not. The long-arm statute of Illinois makes it very plain that a tort is sufficient. And that's what the plaintiff relies upon. That's the plaintiff relies upon also the decision of Rose versus Franchetti from this court, where it was plainly said that a single telephone call is sufficient in the context of a tort to establish the personal jurisdiction.
What's the evidence that any of the defendants here made this phone call?
The evidence, Judge, really, if you have to go to the supplemental appendix and you go to the agreement made between the state of West Virginia, of which Mr. Michael Thompson was a member at that time, and they made an agreement in return for this nolo contendere plea. And they made an agreement that nothing in the proceedings would go outside the state of West Virginia.
That doesn't answer Judge Wood's question. What evidence is there that any of these named defendants had anything to do with the telephone call?
Michael D. Thompson is the prosecuting attorney of the state of Wisconsin. He personally participated in that agreement, and it was his responsibility personally with regard to the state of Wisconsin.
West Virginia?
Judge, I'm so sorry. I was going to come to that comment later because I, rereading my briefs, I noticed that. I have the wonderful knack of switching Wisconsin and West Virginia. I apologize to West Virginia, and I apologize to Wisconsin.
Who made the phone call?
It was noted to be a prosecuting attorney from Berkeley County.
Okay, who's not a defendant.
Who's not a defendant. That was the point that...
I'm struggling with that fact.
I think that Judge Cannelli struggled with it also. I have no trouble with it because, frankly, this case arose under a 12B6. And Judge Cannelli would not even entertain the idea of discovery. In my mind, the question of how Hemline ever found out about the matter involving Mr. Smith is still a mystery to me today, although I'm starting now to get more information to horse the record. I'm beginning to find out how Mr. Hemline found out.
But, you know, Mr. Minning, moving away from personal jurisdiction for a moment, there are a couple of things that are really troublesome about your theory. One of them is the fact that it's pretty well established that each state has responsibility for its own public health, safety, morals, and welfare, its own police power. So the fact that one state, West Virginia here, has told somebody that his name may not appear on a sex offender registry does not preclude another state from having a different rule about what disclosure it wants available for its citizens. So that's one thing. Another thing is that this all really smacks to me of a very elaborate attempted collateral attack in Illinois on things that happened a really long time ago in West Virginia. And under today's world, you were talking about 12B6 just now, post-Twombly, post-Iqbal, the allegations in a complaint need to have some basic plausibility. They need to have some hope of carrying forward with a claim, and I think that's a problem as well. Now, I also have the same issues with personal jurisdiction that Judge Hamilton was exploring. I mean, I guess your theory is that once Mr. Henlein makes the phone call, everybody else who ever touched this case in West Virginia is somehow swept in. But I think that's a very broad theory.
I don't believe, Judge Wood, that that is the argument that I'm propounding. I believe that what I'm trying to propound and trying to answer your questions and Judge Hamilton's questions is that you have to become very familiar with the West Virginia habeas corpus.
Why? Why is
because
it at all
relevant
to Illinois?
That's what sets the case law in effect. That is the whole body of law right there. West Virginia says, in agreement with Mr. Smith, we will consider this opinion or consider this matter closed as to the rest of the United States. That was the agreement. That's why.
But that can't bind Illinois, and if somebody makes a phone call to Illinois, why is that something that he has a right to complain about?
It does bind Illinois.
No, it doesn't.
With all respect.
It actually doesn't. But,
well, then the case pending in the Circuit Court of Cook County, because that's the very argument that one of the judges there said, is that you cannot bind us. West Virginia can't tell me what to do. That was the judge's comment to horse the record. But that's exactly what he's saying.
Why can't it?
Because the Constitution says Illinois must give full faith and credit, not just to the conviction, but to any amendment to that conviction. And that's what happened here. And I invite the court to study that habeas corpus. That's what the plaintiff's case relies upon. And the personal jurisdiction argument really depends upon whether or not Franchetti is still good law. If it is, Mr. Smith was arrested. There's a tort. And that's what he's relying upon. He's saying Judge Connelly, the district court, overlooked the fact that there was a tort here, and that's where the jurisdiction comes from. If you apparently believe that there was no personal jurisdiction, then the question arises, are all the requirements of 54B met here? And frankly, this court has to determine its own jurisdiction in that regard. But we do not believe that the district court was correct with regard to jurisdiction. And I'd like to, I believe, reserve the rest of the time.
Very good, Mr. Okay. Mr. Sanders?
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Michael Sanders, and today I'll be presenting the argument for all of the appellees, Jefferson County Board, Mr. Thompson, the Diddens, as well as Mr. Hamstead. And for today's purposes, I'll be talking about my clients as the West Virginia defendants, as we did in our papers and below. Today we have two contentions. First, the trial court properly dismissed this case on the basis of personal jurisdiction. Second, the court properly exercised its discretion when it entered the Rule 54B finding. For the rest of the issues in terms of statute of limitations, subject matter jurisdiction, and immunities, I'm going to stand on my briefs, but I'm prepared to answer any questions the court may have. Before I get to my first contention, there was an argument raised for the first time today on appeal with regard to whether or not the full faith and credit clause requires Illinois to honor this agreement in West Virginia. I believe just a few weeks ago, March 17th, the court issued the Rosen case, which said that under the full faith and credit clause, Illinois does not have to honor the agreement in West Virginia. Illinois has its power under the police, its police powers to decide whoever has to register as a sex offender. Illinois makes that decision, not West Virginia. But turning to our first contention, the trial court properly dismissed this case on the basis of a lack of personal jurisdiction. The plaintiff has the burden to put in his complaint the requisite factual matters showing personal jurisdiction over each and every defendant.
He does?
How much?
I thought it was just if the question was raised, if the argument was raised. Well, he has to show subject matter jurisdiction.
but it has to show personal jurisdiction, and if it's challenged, and we can challenge that by way of affidavit.
Right. Well, let's move on to that.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to move on to that, too, because, I mean, you usually just allege personal jurisdiction, and the district court's entitled to have a preliminary hearing or proceeding or whatever you want to call it. Should there be a challenge to personal jurisdiction, and the district court can take affidavits or, you know, for that matter, even depositions or documents can be looked at to resolve that preliminary question. So what? How much did the district court dig into the facts here?
Well, in this case, first of all, he had affidavits from nearly every defendant, if I recall correctly. He reviewed those affidavits.
And were those facts contested, or are we really here trying to decide the legal effect of the facts that everybody agrees with?
The facts were not contested by the plaintiff in the underlying case. The only response, and we was talked about today about this alleged phone call, mystery phone call by supposedly Mr. Thompson coming from West Virginia to Illinois.
Maybe not,
no,
Mr. Thompson.
Not Thompson.
That's my point. It was not Mr. Thompson. In the briefs before this court, the plaintiff alleges it was Mr. Thompson. But that's the first time that occurred. In the underlying case, not only did Mr. Thompson specifically state in his affidavit that he had nothing to do with contacting the Illinois Attorney General, but in his complaint, the plaintiff alleged it was this Mr. Josh Henlon. That's a new fact on appeal that the plaintiff has brought out about this phone call. But the court had this information before him, had these affidavits. The opportunity was had for the plaintiff to come forth with some sort of counter affidavit, a point to some factual matter to suggest that there's a question of fact. And that never happened. So the court had before him the affidavits of everybody, had the complaint, looked at it and realized there was no personal jurisdiction because there was nothing by the plaintiffs, by the defendants, to direct their activities toward Illinois in this case.
So the court had before it, I see all these kind of docket sites, affidavits suggesting that it was Josh Henlon, the Berkeley County prosecutor, who phoned asking for some help with a Berkeley County warrant.
Well, in terms of Josh Henlon, the court had the allegations of the plaintiff, which were fairly specific. Mm-hmm. He also had from the plaintiff a document number 112, I believe, mm-hmm. some documents from the Illinois Attorney General, specifically summarizing a conversation with Mr. Henlon, and also enclosing the facsimile from Mr. Henlon, enclosing the warrant and so forth. As well as the affidavits from all the other defendants as well. And the court was able to look at that and realize this says nothing about the West Virginia defendants at all. And I should point out, Thompson, who again on appeal is being alleged to have made this phone call and sort of the bad guy, allegedly, he's the Jefferson County prosecutor. This Mr. Henlon comes from Berkeley County. And that sort of makes sense because that's Berkeley County Magistrate Court is the one who issued the warrant for Mr. Smith's arrest.
I have really bad West Virginia geography, and I wondered which cities, if anything, are near either Berkeley County or Jefferson County.
I'm sorry, I have to admit, I have as bad a geography myself. I've only been to Morgantown, I believe, and I don't know what county it was.
Just wondering.
Further, the plaintiff tries to allege some sort of personal jurisdiction based on conspiracy theory of jurisdiction. As we point out in our papers, Illinois, in the case of Plens versus Electrolux, as well as Canals versus Guidry, has found that Illinois does not recognize any conspiracy theory of jurisdiction. In those cases, the court reviewed the history of personal jurisdiction. In the Plens case, for example, went back many, many cases with the United States Supreme Court and found that conspiracy theory of jurisdiction does not comport with the traditional notions of fair play and substantial justice. And the reason
it's okay in criminal cases, but not in civil cases.
Apparently in civil cases, it's not. And so the plaintiff cannot rely on conspiracy theory of jurisdiction. And then turning to our second contention in terms of 54B, the court properly exercised its discretion to find that there was a sufficient reason to find no reason to delay the appeal in this case.
So this case is going along, I take it, with respect to the Cook County defendants, but this is something that finally resolved, in your view, everything having to do with your clients.
Absolutely. The matters going forward have to do with the police officers Salome and Flores with regard to whether or not they mistreated the plaintiff when they arrested him in 2007, even 2 years later than the alleged phone call that happened in this case. The court was well within its right to look at that and see what issues are going to be tried and realize that it has nothing to do with us or actions that we allegedly took nearly 20 years ago in West Virginia and realized there was no reason to have us around. And therefore, the court properly found the Rule 54B finding. Unless there are, Your Honors have any other questions, we ask the court to affirm the ruling of the trial court. And on the issues I didn't get to today, I'm happy to answer any questions, but otherwise I'd stand on my brief.
Thank you, Mr. Saunders. Mr. Maine.
Well, if it please the court, Mr. Smith, the appellant, was not relying upon a conspiracy theory. I understand where he might have been misled by the fact that one person in a conspiracy makes a call or continues an act, then it continues as to all the conspirators. But this case was basically a conspiracy that began in West Virginia and leaped over all the states in between to Illinois by that one phone call. For the court, in my 5 years now with this case, Charleston is at the south end of West Virginia. Martinsburg is in Berkeley County. That's like the county seat. And Jefferson County is just immediately to the east.
Thank you.
I don't know if that helps. But,
it does.
It does. Thank you.
Does it? All right. I do rely upon the fact that this is 12b-6, and there was a lot said here recently about affidavits. My training never allowed affidavits to be brought into a 12b-6.
No,
it's,
but 12b-2.
It's sufficiency of law.
But 12b-2, you can do it. You have to do it.
You might have to do it, but I never saw any affidavits. Now, that's what I have to say in the record. And I made that point in my briefs. What affidavits are we talking about? What hearing are we talking about? I'm the only counsel. Nobody ever called me up and said, we're going to have a hearing, or Judge Kennelly's clerks ever called and said, we're going to have a hearing on this. That never happened. So I'm at a loss to understand how we got out of, I'm not at a loss because I understand that this 12b-6 and 8a-1 keep getting crisscrossed in this case. And I don't understand how that happens, but it does. Judge Kennelly had no trouble with some of his affirmative defenses. Now, the 12B2, Judge Hamilton, you're absolutely right. There should have been a hearing. Somebody should have said, look, I'm troubled by this. Let's have a hearing. That never happened. With regard to the full faith and credit being raised for the first time, I never realized that that was an argument to be raised for the first time. I apologize to the court. It's not my intention, and it's not my practice to pull surprises on opposing counsel. So I will have to rest on my brief. I would like to answer if any possible questions regarding personal jurisdiction, but I think that is the key to this case and also to the 54B. I ask that the decision of the court be reversed and remanded with directions.
Thanks, man. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.